Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Rates and Lanes podcast. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad. Be joined shortly by my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. So we're getting ready to push the brakes in for this episode of the Rates and Lanes podcast. We're happy that you guys could join us this evening. We're going to start off the show as we normally always do with this week's National Trend Lines report. We are showing that the national average price of diesel fuel has crept down slightly by 0.3 percentage points, showing that the national average price of diesel fuel is at $3.13 per gallon. So for over the previous week, flatbed spot rates continued to climb, with the national average adding another 5 cents per mile. The national average is now 81 cents higher than the same time last year and 26 cents higher than the same time in 2018 during the last capacity crunch that we had. So let's take a deeper dive and see how the other rates were performing across each segment type, starting out with the dry vans. And so we're going to take a look in, beginning up in the northeastern portion of the United States, showing a national average spot market rate for dry vans at $2.42 per mile. Moving down south to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing an average rate of $2.59 per mile on the spot market for dry vans. Climbing up into the Midwest, we're showing an average rate of $2.92 per mile. Dropping down to the south central region of the United States, we're showing an average rate at $2.37 per mile. And wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, we're showing an average spot market rate for dry vans at $2.66 per mile. Moving on, going into the flatbed portion of the report, starting out in the Northeast, we're showing the average outbound spot market rate for flatbeds at $2.92 per mile. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern portion of the United States, we're showing a healthy outbound spot market rate average of $3.10 per mile. Moving up into the Midwest, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate at $3.24. Coming out of the south central region, we're showing an average rate at $2.62. And we got the West Coast bringing up the rear, showing that the national average spot market rate coming out of the West Coast is at $2.43 per mile, which still is not bad. You really cannot knock that kind of a rate per mile on the spot market, especially. Jumping over, changing gears, going into the temperature control portion of the report, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate for reefers at $2.64 per mile. Moving now to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate for reefers at $2.71. Coming out of the Midwest, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate for reefers at $3.33. Moving now to the south central region of the United States, we're showing an average rate of $2.85 per mile for reefers. And wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate at $2.99. Good news to report this week, we do not have any new entrants to make their way onto the bad broker report, unlike last week. So we'll definitely take that. And with that being said, let me welcome my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Chuck, good evening. How are you?
We're doing well. How are you, Rico?
I really cannot complain. I cannot complain at all. Been a interesting week thus far. Getting ready for the upcoming CVSA weekend that's coming up upon us. So, you know, kind of getting things, kind of getting, doing a little house cleaning, getting ducks in a row, getting ready, getting prepared for that whole situation.
Well, I think we should get prepared way before. We should always be prepared for the worst. You know, hope for the best and prepare for the worst at all times.
Well,
it seems to work.
You're right. As they say, if you stay ready, you ain't got to get ready.
That's right. Exactly. And now with these new desktop audits, I tell everybody, just be, you know, you don't have time to clamber around and start, you know, fudging records. Keep everything straight right from the beginning, because there's just you're going to get 48 hours notice, and you don't know where you're going to be for 24 or 40 or all of those 48 hours before you get that notice. Rico, without any further ado, we've got a real special guest tonight. Do you see Stephen Q there?
I do.
Bring him on, because Steve Vaselli, welcome to the Rates and Lanes podcast.
Hey, Chuck. Hey, Rico. It's great to be with you guys.
Well, it's great. It's a real honor to have you. For our audience, our listeners, the Chief is from Pennsylvania. He is a economic and political sociologist who studies inequality organizations, work and labor markets. He is also the author of the book, The Big Rig, Trucking, The Decline of the American Dream. He's got amazing credentials, and I think I could go on for quite a while talking about who he is and what he's done. But he is a faculty fellow at the Kleinman Center for Energy Policy and lecturer in the Department of Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. And he's really familiar with trucking, and I don't think that anybody can throw anything at him that he doesn't understand. And if I'm not mistaken, understands it firsthand. Steve, you hold a CDL, don't you?
I do. I have for about the last 15 years. Yep.
Wow. that is so cool. Because, you know, usually people that are policy, you know, that have anything to do with studying policy or making policy, making decisions, any of that, most of them don't know the inside of a truck from a bowling ball. And I got to hand it to you. I'm really impressed.
Yeah, so I grew up around a lot of trucks because my father actually ran a truck scale at a factory where, you know, every guy in my family had worked at the same factory. And so as a kid, I was around, you know, these trucks at kind of the end points, and that's what sort of sparked my interest. And then in college, I worked for United Van Lines, so was riding around with others driving, you know, just loading and unloading furniture, and then had a chance in 2005 to go out and drive van for about 6 months for an over the road carrier before I started doing some interviews for the book.
Wow, that's incredible. Now, I heard a podcast on National Public Radio, NPR, called The Big Rig. Now, was that a podcast a takeoff on your book?
You know, not that they told me, though they did use the same title. They did discuss some of my work in there, but they were more focused, if I remember correctly, on some of the lease purchase agreements and some of the challenges to those. Yeah.
We refer to those as the never-never plan. We're always telling people to stay away from them because 99% of them are, they just don't work. And I'm sure you've seen a lot of that during your studies.
Well, as one driver who summed up my book said, thou shalt not lease, was his takeaway from it. You know, that was one of the things that when I got into the industry and to study it, you know, I was really interested in what had happened after deregulation and how it had changed the, you know, the working conditions. And as I'm sure you cover a lot, you know, the downward pressure on wages for a lot of drivers. And I was not expecting to study independent contracting. You know, it was really some of the experienced drivers that I interviewed that said, hey, you know, if you want to see what's really undercutting us out here. You know, you got to look at some of these, you know, rotten apples here that are, you know, sort of making labor cheaper and cheaper in an unsustainable way, you know, with this high, these high turnover plans, et cetera. And that it was really the drivers who pointed it out to me first as something that, you know, really needed more attention.
I certainly got it. Mind you, there's some of those never plans still out there, believe it or not. But I'm guessing they're starting to fall. People are getting wise, and because of social media, I could be right or wrong, but I think that there's less and less of those plans all the time. What's your opinion on that? Do you think
I think there's some that are still, just, you know, particularly in refrigerated, you still see some of the bigger carriers who are trying to push the plans, and you know they're we're having some big fights in the U.S. around, you know, AB5 and others that are, you know, would put a big,
right.
Put a big hurdle in front of those. But I do think you're right that, you know, the internet really changed things, right? I mean, drivers being able to talk to one another and sort of share stories and communicate. It doesn't, you know, it's not always the end of the discussion for a lot of people. They'll still go out and try it themselves. But, you know, drivers are certainly, you know, talking more about it. And you're seeing some big challenges with some of these class action lawsuits and companies really racking up big bills and unpaid wages, you know, a few years down the road that are, I think, making some of them think again about it.
Well, they're taking advantage of the situation. If you read, some of these stories, they're heartbreaking. And, you know, and it's just people trying to get ahead at the end of the, you know, and these are people that, if they were treated with respect and dignity, I think they would stay in the industry. I think part of the issue, and I want to hear your thoughts on this, part of the issue with our shortage of drivers, I think the industry has done it ourselves by mistreating them, not just at the trucking company level, but at the shippers and receivers and all over. It's just not a fun job.
I got a question I want to
throw in to kind of jump in on the conversation on this piece right here, because I was listening to an interesting conversation earlier today. I believe I was on CNBC, and they had a lot of business owners, and everybody was talking about, you know, with the opening back up and trying to get people back to work, and how difficult it is right now, which is compounded with the quote-unquote driver shortage, with getting people just to even come back to work. I mean, the restaurant owners are complaining about not even having servers and different things because of, you know, people have jumped off and went into the gig economy, and also with all of the different stimulus packages and unemployment packages that are out there and that are available, you know, until September at least, people are making more money just sitting at home and collecting those benefits versus going out and getting a job. So I'm really interested to see, you know, to kind of get your take on that whole situation as well. Compounded with what we already have been dealing with the shortage that we have in the industry.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, on the short-term stuff, I think there's, you know, we'll see what the data ends up saying in the end, but it's hard not to believe that, you know, workers aren't going to take a job closer to home, right, that if they're going to take something, that they're going to, you know, they're going to choose something closer to home where they're going to get a decent wage if they can. So I don't think it's going to, you know, certainly the, you know, enhanced unemployment and things like that are not going to make it easier to recruit anybody into long haul driving. But I do think that, you know, the underlying problem, before I came on, I was actually just thinking about this. I think we're roughly in our 35th year of the driver shortage as I understand it. You know, I've gone back historically and sort of look, the first mention I can find is in 1985, which is sort of the original, you know, disruption from deregulation had really, you know, hit hard and disrupted markets, and truckload was, you know, evolving into what, you know, what it would be today, right? So you started to see, you know, people sending drivers out in random patterns for weeks at a time, you know, sitting unpaid at docks, paid by the mile, you know, that sort of thing that we're still living with today. So, you know, from what I can tell going back, you know, other than periods of recession, you know, 2001, after the housing crisis, and now this, we've essentially had a driver shortage, right, nonstop, that entire time. Now, it intensifies, and I do think, you know, for the first time, I'm starting to hear employers who normally don't have trouble hiring saying even they can't find drivers. So I do think we might be in a different phase of the driver shortage. And part of that is I think we've burned through so much of the potential driver supply. And I think that's why, you know, a big part of the reason that we're seeing this aging driving force, right, driver force, is because, you know, those young people, they're getting burned. They're coming into these companies that put them out on the road for, you know, weeks or even months at a time. And they say, you know what, yeah, the wage is better than I can get, you know, down the street, but I'd love to see my family, you know, and I'd love to, you know, I don't mind putting in 60 hours a week even. And, you know, a lot of these guys are putting 80 hours in a week. They say, I wouldn't mind putting in 60 hours a week, but I'd like to see my family. I'd like to be able to enjoy, you know, see the kids' baseball games and things like that. And, you know, when you have that lifestyle as kind of the requirement of the job, it's going to be tough to keep young people there, especially if they're thinking about having a girlfriend or, you know, kids or anything like that. You know, that's going to be hard to keep.
Good point. Now, that brings us into that topic of allowing the 18-year-olds to start driving interstate, and I'm going to presume some of this is out of sheer desperation of the trucking industry to bring on some young talent, because, you know, the guys are aging out. Those are the guys and girls that don't want to do anything else for fear, because number one, they can't, or that's all they know, or they love it. But even those people, they're reaching a point, you know, they're 65 or 70 years old and they don't want to pound pavement anymore.
Yeah, boy, this is a, you know, for me, Chuck, this is a tough one because, you know, I mean, I want young people to be able to you know, come into the industry who are interested in it and you know, start on a good career path. The problem, I think, and this is the problem with the argument that I'm hearing from APA and others on this, is they say, well, look, we got these drivers who are, you know, driving the length of California or driving the length of Texas. You know, what's the difference if they, you know, cross state lines?
Right.
And the difference is we know the kind of routine that they're likely to be in right out of the gate. They're going to be in one of these big training companies. They're going to be in these, you know, these you know, systems that push 35-year-olds to drive too long sometimes, right, and make really dumb mistakes about sort of fatigue management and stuff. I just can't see an 18-year-old, 19, 20-year-old, you know, with their safety records being put into that kind of training system, which is hard enough for a, you know, responsible adult who's a, you know, we know are much safer drivers. I mean, we know that, but, you know, the data is very clear. 25 years old is when you start to become a safer driver, right? You know, we might want to even push that up to 25. But, you know, what happens if we let them go interstate is we're going to put them into the toughest, you know, fatigue management situation, that random pattern over the road, manage your own hours, you know, and that's the last place we want them. So if we had them in, you know, in interstate is where we want them. We want them, you know, doing short runs home at night, getting a good night's sleep or whatever they're doing at night, you know, young people. We don't want them out on the road for weeks at a time, you know, learning to manage their fatigue at that age. I just don't I don't see how that works out safety-wise.
Well, I totally agree with you there. You cannot take an 18-year-old or most 18-year-olds and let them loose with a tractor trailer running from New York to California and back. There's it's too big a yard for the, you know, for a young pup to get lost in and make bad decisions. But you can, I think, under a controlled environment where you say to somebody, okay, you're going to drive from, you know, from Atlanta to Charlotte. You know, that's your run. I think the important thing, and this is not just for 18-year-olds, I think this is for for every driver, I think the more familiar truck drivers are with where they're going, the safer they're going to be. And I think when you take any driver, even a well-seasoned driver, and you put them in strange environments, you take a guy that's been running from California to Florida for 40 years and send them into Manhattan or into Jersey, totally different terrain. So when you take that same guy that's been running from, let's say, New Jersey to Florida for 40 years and put him in the mountains in the middle of the winter, through the Rockies, through Colorado or something, you got a disaster. So within the trucking industry, I think we have different areas of expertise and abilities that I think we overlook. And I do think I understand what you're saying 100%. And I agree with you partially, but I still think that one of the problems we're having, if we're not getting them at 18, we're not getting them, because the problem is by the time they're 21 or 23 years old, they've gone on to be, to some sort of other post-secondary, education. They've either gone to university or community college, and they've either gone into a trade, whether it's plumbing or accounting as a profession, but they're doing something else. And the trucking industry will never have these people as a rule, the vast majority. And we've got a hunger for people right now like never before. So I think that's the main reason behind it.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts?
No, I agree with that. I think you're right. I think the key is figuring out how do we create safe, effective, training systems and entry-level positions that retain people. Right. I mean, we've got a whole bunch of, systems in the trucking industry that repel people, that suck them in, and people in 3 months, 6 months later, sometimes even in debt for that training. Right. And despite that debt, they're like, forget it. I'm gone. They're like, I can't do this. And that, it hurts everybody in the long run. Right. And that's unfortunate. And I think if we didn't have those bigger problems, then we might be able to, more clearly have a conversation to structure programs for these younger drivers to say, look, the sort of effectively the training wheels, here's a route, a couple hundred miles long, you do this for 6 months and then you move on to something else, which is, how a lot of in-house training programs for, if you were going to go to UPS and drive a package car, they don't throw you into the the den with the wolves. They start you out on the training route. And they stay there until you're ready for something more. And they leave the more advanced routes for the more advanced drivers. But we don't. Unfortunately, we do. We throw the beginning new drivers into what is one of the worst setups there is in terms of fatigue and irregularity and hours. New environments every day, new shippers every day. It's like not surprising they're banging into docks and scraping stuff and getting, falling asleep at the wheel.
Yeah. Well, that's been our experience at our company with our own fleet years ago when I had younger drivers. And I had a group of them under 25 at one point. And one of the issues we found was they would not take the rest. This is like 30 odd years ago using paper logs, and the behavior was crazy. And, one of them in particular smashed his truck up, fell asleep right, in Massachusetts, just 5 minutes before his exit. And, so many of us that have driven truck know that whole thing. You've been up all night driving and, the sun's coming up and you go five more minutes. He's got 5 minutes to make it. And I'll be fine. And, 90% of the time you do make it. It's that 10% when you just doze off and boom, you've got a truck wreck. And that's so unforgivable in today's market. The insurance companies don't take kindly to that. They'll cancel your insurance. That's another huge issue that we seem to be, we can't get in front of.
Yeah, Chuck, and one of the things that I learned really quickly when I started doing interviews with more experienced drivers years ago was, and they would all say the same thing. I would ask them at the end of the interview, what advice would you give to a new driver or somebody getting into the industry? And the guys with a lot of experience would say, essentially, you got to look at this career as a marathon and not a sprint. You know, sure, yep. that pay per mile, you want to push it, you want to get that bigger paycheck, but you got to realize your long-term value as a driver comes from that safe driving record and that consistent, conscientious, you know, productivity that you give to an employer. That's what's going to be rewarded. And if you're cutting corners, if you're pushing it a little bit every day, you know, sure, you're going to get away with it, you know, day after day, but eventually you're going to come up to a situation, you know, where you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, a little too tired or whatever you're doing. And it's just not worth it, you know, and you got to be able to, you know, really discipline yourself to say, I'd love to put an extra $100 in my pocket, but, you know, I've also got to, you know, watch my safety. And it's just harder for the younger drivers to sort of learn that lesson.
Yeah. What are some solutions that you think, Steve, that might be able to maybe help us to be able to maybe turn the corner a little bit on this whole driver situation, the whole thing of because, you know, I think with the newer generation of drivers and everything, that it's kind of lost its luster, so to speak. So I'm curious as to have you guys come up with, or are you guys thinking of anything that might be able to help provide some solutions to this already exacerbated situation?
You know, I think we're I made a list of stuff recently that's going on in the industry for a presentation that I gave. And, you know, after I got to, like, 10 things, and it was, like, you know, new administration in the U.S., new DOT secretary, infrastructure bill, electrification, automation, the misclassification stuff, the driver shortage, ELD and hours of service, the under 21, you know, I mean, there's so much happening right now that I think it is the time to think about sort of big picture, you know, solutions of how we incentivize, you know, a system that we create a floor, you know, and there are different parts of it. You know, certainly all the unpaid time, right, is a big part of it. You know, shippers treating drivers' time as if it's free. You know, that's a basic part of, you know, basic outcome of the competitiveness of these markets, right? Nobody's going to tell shippers, you know, hey, you're going to pay my truck like so much per hour, you know, for sitting there. That's a hard thing to tell a shipper, right? And so I think we do need to think about kind of the regulatory environment in a way that puts some puts a floor under these hours to ensure and pay to ensure that we're counting all the time and that the people who should be paying for that time are. So, you know, what exactly does that look like? I mean, I think there are a number of different things that we could do, right? We do need to, I think, look at hours of service. You know, I don't really want to see another iteration of like, well, should drivers be allowed to drive 11 hours or 10 or 13? I think, you know, that's kind of missing the whole point. And the ELD and the way that has rolled out, you know, is,
oh my God,
you know, it has not done what people hoped it would do. It has caused problems. The best intentions, right, when you actually see them play out in this stuff. It just, you know, we've got loopholes you can drive the truck through, whether it's personal conveyance or, adverse conditions or, you know, not counting non-driving time, all that stuff. So we've got to change the economics of, you know, that driver's time so that all that time is, you know, is paid, right, in some way, right, and the bill is being paid by the right person. And if that's the shipper delaying somebody, then that's what's got to, you know, who ultimately has to pay for these. But until we do that and until we stop subsidizing the turnover with training grants and all that other stuff, I think we're sort of feeding the beast, right? And the beast is just cheaper, cheaper, cheaper. Now, with electrification, truck parking, automation, things like that, I think we do have an opening. Right. Things are going to be very different 5-10 years from now than they are today, in my opinion. We haven't even mentioned Amazon. right? I mean, that's like a whole, you know, just what's happening in e-commerce and the impact that that's having. So I think this is a time when, you know, the key is to have people at the table and some honesty, right? I mean, a lot of these policies, ELDs and whatever, right? You know, it was all based on bullshit, quite frankly. Can I say that on the show?
You know, absolutely. But, all you want.
I mean, you know, it was based on this wink, wink, nod, nod. Like, it, so we went through the whole hours of service revisions, right, in the 2000s. And then we got to the ELD mandate, and then we had all these owner-operators who were like, oh, you're going to actually enforce these things? You know, like, oh, well, wait a minute. Like, the 14-hour rule is fine as long as it's on paper, right? But
right.
If you do it electronically, like, it's a whole different thing, yeah. Right? And so we've had these debates that were just not based on the facts, you know, and the industry kind of say, winking and nodding at it, going, yeah, 14 hours a day sounds great. You know, just don't actually make us record it accurately. And so I do think we need to have, you know, people sit down at the table who really know what's going on and to be honest and to say, hey, let's figure out how we put a floor under this so shippers are really paying for that time at the dock. So we can actually, when you look at these big carriers' trucks that are running 7.5, 8 hours a day, that's terrible. I mean, the inefficiency that we've ended up with this model is just, it's kind of absurd.
100%. You know, if you remember, just before the ELD mandate came out, there was a politician from Oregon, Peter DeFazio. God bless him. When they were having the hearings, he said, we can have the, you know, we can go to ELDs, but we have to get on the shippers. We need to make the shippers responsible for the time they're delaying trucks. And, of course, that went over like a lead balloon. and the other thing that they were, I think, the U.S. made a real huge mistake, and we're no better up in Canada, okay? So I will say both countries. We haven't gone. Our ELD mandate starts in June or July with soft enforcement up here. But we have a shortage of truck parking in both countries. Politicians and people writing laws need to open their bloody eyes. Like, if we're supposed to do this legal, how do you expect a person to drive their shift and, you know, they're trying to earn money to feed their family, no different than anybody else, and they figure, well, I'm going to get to this destination, I'll park for the night. They get there and, you know, the place is full. And that's been going on for decades. But, you know, as you mentioned briefly about Amazon, the amount of freight that has the increase in freight because of e-commerce is incredible. So now you've got even more pressure against those precious parking spots that are so far and few between. We have to set, we have to set some guidelines here.
Yeah, and, you know, we're getting pushback now. You know, there's a lot of concern in the infrastructure bill debate around, you know, the truck parking lobby, essentially the truck stops, right? Who are saying, you know, we don't want you to build them, you know, we don't want big public lots away from where we're making money on our services. When, you know, everybody knows that they've been, you know, going to this gas and go model. No, they're not making any money off parking spots, so they don't want to provide them.
Yeah.
And now they're saying other people can't provide them either. It's like, well, you know, so the truck stops. I mean, I think we really do have to put some pressure on them to say, hey, look, you know, if you can't monetize the thing and make any money off it, there's got to be somewhere for people to park. You know, so you can't stand in the way and not build the lot. So
100%.
Right.
Trucks need a place to stop. You know, a perfect place. We have all these shopping plazas and retail stores that have gone out of business. That's a perfect place for trucks to park.
Yeah, I've been pushing this idea of these things I call urban truck ports, which would be kind of these drop lots outside. So you basically take that map in the U.S. of congestion points, you know, bottlenecks, and right outside the bottlenecks, you find some brownfields, you find some cheap land, and you build drop lots where you could, you know, either park or drop a trailer and have, you know, sort of a truck-to-truck intermodal kind of thing. You put the electrification charge, you know, put the chargers there for the urban trucks, whatever you want to do. But that, you know, we put them at the endpoints close to the cities where drivers would like to lay up oftentimes. It's not going to work for everybody. But, you know, sure. rather than build them, you know, where we have parking now, put them, you know, on the edge of the city so that you get there during rush hour and you say, all right, I'm taking a nap or I'm dropping the trailer or whatever it is. That's what I've been sort of arguing to folks about, where if we do public parking, that's where we should put the new spots.
I think that's a great idea. We have to be realistic. And I was just reading today in one of the trade rags about a group that's anti, they don't want truck stops in their areas, not in my backyard. Well, how the heck do these people think that their paper goods and food and everything else gets to them? You know, we have to support this industry. It's the undercarriage of everything.
Yeah, and I don't know how people aren't seeing these entrance and exit ramps, you know, lined with trucks every time they get on the interstate. And I don't know if it just doesn't sink in what's actually happening there, you know, a driver who's just parked on the side of the road without services, without access to a bathroom, trying to get a night's sleep
exactly.
to do their job.
These are basic human functions, you know. Years ago, when I got into the industry back in 1974 and it was regulated then, we didn't have these issues. And if there were issues, it was a different landscape and you had a lot of, you had 30 or 40 mega carriers in the United States and they could go and lobby and get things done. It's much more difficult for a group of, hundreds of thousands of small carriers that have, one to five trucks. They don't have a lot of, they really don't have a lot of lobby ability.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. There's often, conflicting voices within the industry itself, which hurts quite a bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Steve, there's one thing, one of the questions I was wanting to ask you. What do you see if you look in your crystal ball with electric trucks? Are they coming to market very quickly? Is this kind of pie in the sky? What's your honest to goodness here?
So I think it's all about policy. A heavy thumb on the scale will make a big difference here. But there's so many unknowns. So, average length of haul has been going down and down, right? And that's good for electric. The price, the cost parity, now for local trucks, it looks good for electric. We're getting close, in the foreseeable future, we could see it for regional applications. Now, charging infrastructure is a whole nother ball of wax. Like the cost of charging infrastructure, I think the cost of batteries, the trucks themselves are going to come down. But where is that charging going to be, and can I afford with a fleet of 50 or 100 trucks to put in chargers if that fleet is going to, come in all at once and need to charge overnight? I need 50 chargers, something like that. The cost of that is going to be prohibitive. The big, some of the big issues I think are around autonomy. So, and I'm not talking full driverless, but the kind of autonomy that let's say these trucks we get to the point in 5 years where collision avoidance and lane maintenance mean that we're not going to have major wrecks. Let's hope we get there, right? At that point, if I'm a carrier, I think I go to the FMCSA and I say, look, this truck can't hit anything, right? I should be allowed to operate this truck. Yeah, I should be able to allowed to operate this truck 2 more hours a day, 3 more hours a day on the highway because the risk, only justification for hours of service is safety, right? Now you've got, I think that you could see that average length of haul start to creep back up, right? You got some freight maybe you can pull off rail, capture back some of that intermodal stuff because you're a little faster and your costs are coming down. That's bad for electrification, right? If our average length of haul keeps going down, I think, electric becomes more and more attractive, especially with some of the incentives we're going to see in places like California, et cetera. That's before we get the no diesel zones or whatever we might see out there. But if we get autonomy that starts to lengthen that average length of haul, and starts to pull freight off of rail, then I think we're, you know, we're looking at a, you know, a diesel dependent or diesel future for longer than people think.
Interesting. I think that the rail in a lot of lanes is maxed out right now. So there's nowhere else for that freight to go but onto the highways.
Yeah, absolutely.
And especially in the world that we're living in, you know, the just in time, no inventory. We're in the thick of it now. And rail is great for certain commodities. We actually sell rail service to some of our customers. But some commodities we strongly, you know, some products we don't want to put on the rail because we know the customer can't afford delays. And there's, you know, listen, highways can close too. But, you know, when you have a derailment of a track somewhere, nothing's going to happen with that freight. It's not going to move.
Yeah, and I don't see any end to, you know, moving stuff faster, further, you know, as the goal of shippers. You know, I just think we're going to see, you know, more demand. And if costs come down, you know, for that service, people are just going to use more of it, right? Sort of what we've seen over time.
Yeah. So you mentioned something very briefly as far as autonomous trucks. You know, I don't think we're not going to see trucks operating up and down an interstate without a driver for decades probably. But my way of thinking, I want to know your opinion, is the more autonomous we can make a truck, the easier it will be to get new drivers. Because it's not going to, you know, you look at the trucks today, they've got automatic transmissions because most people don't get a chance to learn how to drive a manual. So we're attracting those people. And if we've got collision avoidance and everything else, it becomes a safer, more user-friendly environment.
So I think we could, you know, again, for me, these are, you know, policy matters will weigh heavily on these. So I like to think about automation in these stages. I think there's certainly companies out there that are going to try to replace the driver and have drive, you know, Too Simple or whoever, you know, they say they're going to have a truck on the road with no driver on I-10, you know, in the next couple of years. And, you know, they've convinced at least the OEMs that at least they need to be thinking about the, you know, fuller systems of autonomy. But in the meantime, you know, we've got forward collision avoidance and all those things that are pretty steadily advancing. Now, I mean, if for the drivers listening, I know I hear nothing but bad stories about these systems from drivers who, you know, have problems with them because they're just not there yet, right? Where we would like them to be. But when we think about the new drivers today, when I learned to drive a truck 15 years ago, you had to know how to shift the truck. You had to know how to read a map. You had to know how to enter your hours of service in a logbook. You had to know how to manage those hours, right? You had greater flexibility because of that paper log, but you needed to know how to really manage your movement, you know, weather, traffic, et cetera. Today, you don't have to do any of those things. And those are all forms of automation, right? We've got automated shifting. We've got automated mapping. You know, now with the communications, the way that people are using the onboard computers, you know, managers can sort of nudge drivers and, you know, see when their 10-hour break is up and say, hey, get moving. You know, so we've already de-skilled that job through automation quite a bit. And I think we're just going to see that continue. So, you know, what's the big fear with these inexperienced drivers? They're going to run over a minivan. You know, well, when they can no longer run over a minivan, then you could put anybody in there, right? That's the risk is that, you know, I think if we automate more and we de-skill more, that value of that, you know, that driver with 100, 200,000 safe miles who's ready to now go into a, you know, who now has the record to get a good, really good job, you know, they're not going to have as much value on the market as we do that. And I worry that that's going to, you know, make the job less attractive, unfortunately. Now, that's a matter of, you know, are these people getting paid, you know, when they're at the dock, when they're sleeping overnight on the road? Like, you know, are they making a wage, or are we just, you know, we're going to squeeze more pennies out of that driver's pocket to the point where they say, not worth the lifestyle?
Well, we've done that. You know what? I think our industry has blown through every single cheap driver we could find in the continent. We've done a really good job on that one. You know, this was, you know, years ago, this was a very well-respected, decent-paying job. If I'm not mistaken, in 1978, a union driver, and I'm not a union guy, but I will say that a union guy made the equivalent of $91,000 in, I think, 2020 dollars. So it was a decent paying job. A man could afford to educate his children and buy a home and buy a car and be home every night to take his kid to the baseball game.
Yeah.
Or to lacrosse or ballet.
Yeah.
And we've lost that. And I think somewhere, if we're going to get ahead of this driver shortage, we've got to get back a little bit to where we were, not totally. And I don't think unionizing works, because it didn't work last time. But what I do think is treating people with respect and paying them for their time and not abusing them. You know, I think those are important things that the industry has kind of forgotten, and we kind of need to go back. Now, Steve, have you considered through your studies and everything else the benefits if trucking companies just went back to the way it used to be prior to deregulation? And I will go on record here. I was a huge believer in deregulating the trucking industry, and we can go into that later on another time. But we used to pay drivers by the hour at one time in the industry. And as far as I know, back in those days, there was no such thing as a driver shortage. As a matter of fact, there was a lineup of people wanting that job. Is that the missing link here? Okay.
I do think that contrast is really interesting. I mean, again, when I would talk to older drivers about how they got in their industry, they would tell me, hey, I was on call for a year and a half waiting to get into this job. You know, like,
yeah,
that was the, you know, that was the thing. People were lined up. I do think that, you know, the operational changes that came along with deregulation that, you know, were cheaper, right? They're the root of the problem. And they're not just the root of the problem for drivers. I mean, again, you look at, it was J.B. Hunt, I think, 5 or 6 years ago that put out a study about hours of service. And, you know, that was the one that, you know, folks cite about that 7.5-8 hours of revenue generating time on the road. There are multiple problems that stem from the fact that, you know, we don't pay people. So we don't, you know, and you know, the cost of trucks is going up, but it's not prohibitive, you know, it's not cost prohibitive to park that truck overnight and use it as a rolling motel. Which is just like,
sure,
you know, you go to any other business model and you'd say, all right, your main capital investment, you know, this truck is going to sit idle 2/3 of the day while somebody is sleeping in it or waiting in it, you know, to use it. I mean, it's just that kind of inefficiency, right, is crazy. And it comes from, you know, that random pattern, send folks all around, you know, kind of approach, and not that focused, you know, lanes to the terminals. There's been some work done, not in recent times, but 10, 15 years ago, I guess it's like 15 years ago, J.B. Hunt, you know, said, all right, we're going to go to, before they went big into intermodal, so maybe it was a little bit longer than that, you know, they said, hey, we're just going to go hub and spoke. You know, the cost of running everywhere are just not working for us. I think they saw some savings. They also saw, you know what, we're going to go in a different direction altogether. There just isn't the margin here in truckload. And that's when they made the big move into intermodal. So it's, you know, it's in some ways it's just the cheaper, easier way to go to sort of, you know, run these random patterns with cheap labor for the truckload carriers.
But it's not scalable. That's the problem. When you have, when you've got dozens of trucks parked against the fence with no drivers, how is that working? Especially in a market like we have now, where Freitas, I've never seen it this hot in my whole life. This is, you know, what we're seeing now is just never seen. It's insane. When you talk to people that have, you know, 10% of their trucks sitting against the dock because they can't find drivers, and they don't want to change, they don't want to change how they're remunerating the drivers, there's something wrong.
I couldn't agree more.
So I'm wondering if we will eventually go back to an hourly wage settlement just to get over this.
I think we should. And you know, that doesn't mean you can't still have incentives, right? I mean, you can pay hourly and still have 100%. Bonuses and all kinds of other things that, you know, that make drivers, you know, have some skin in the game for productivity. But, you know, the whole pay by the mile thing, right, this is an artifact of when you didn't know what somebody was doing, right? And you say, all right, you know, you're going to get paid based on what you get done because I'm not going to stand over your shoulders and watch you. But we do that now.
Right.
You know, we've got satellite tracking and cellular tracking. You know, we know where the truck is, how fast it's going, how long, what the dwell time at the customer was. You know exactly what that driver did. So your justification now for pay per mile really gone, other than shifting the inefficiency onto the driver. That's the only thing you've done.
Yeah.
Say, hey, look, you know, if you sit unpaid, it's on you. You know, I mean, it's not our fault. You know, we're not going to pay you for your time if you get it delayed at the shipper. You know, so the whole justification for pay per mile on the, you know, productivity side is gone now, essentially.
Yeah. You know, you think back to where we were and where we are, and remember when we were paying by the hour, fuel was a hell of a lot cheaper, and trucks were a lot cheaper, insurance was a lot cheaper, and freight rates, believe it or not, were even more money then than they are now.
I believe you.
Well,
and
that
I guess
was the whole thing.
You mentioned respect earlier. And I hear that all the time. And you know what tells drivers you respect them? You pay for their time. You know, when you're stuck at a dock and, you know, for 4 hours, the way you say I respect you is say, hey, you know, it's $30 an hour while you're sitting there, you know, or whatever it is. You know, if you're waiting, you know, sorry you got delayed. We're paying you for your time. That respect in my book.
No, I agree. You know, it seems that we've gone into, you know, as an industry, and I think it probably started with Amazon, really, and they've done a great job, and other companies have followed, where they're going to a power-only model, and they're dropping umpteen trailers at shippers' doors, and drivers are picking them up, so they're not having to wait, you know, at a shipper's dock waiting to get loaded or unloaded. And I think that's probably the way of the future. My only concern that I have, even pulling somebody else's trailer, I don't know what condition that trailer's in.
Yeah.
You know, you have a driver pick up a loaded trailer at a dock at 11 o'clock at night or whenever, and he can't see to do as good a circle check, even with a light, as he probably should. And you don't know that equipment. You really don't. You've never pulled it before. You don't sometimes even know who's maintained it. And, you know, you can check your tires and you can check your brakes. But at the end of the day, you don't know if that thing's been greased. So there's got to be better standards.
Yep.
If we're going to adopt this drop and hook, and I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great use of equipment, power equipment, great use of driver's time. I would love to see the industry have a standard, and I'd also love to see the industry adopt disc brakes right through on new equipment.
Mm.
I think we're living in the caveman era by not going to disc brakes. What's your opinion?
Well, I think you're right that this is the crux of the matter here. For some of these, you know, much more efficient ways to get drivers moving. So, you know, and you may know more about this than I do, but, you know, some of these problems have been solved in the trailer pools for chassis. Now, I wouldn't say they're solved completely, but you know, there are models out there, right? And again, you know, some of it gets back to driver pay. right? So, you know, the driver who is getting paid by the mile is going to kick that problem down the road to the next driver if they can, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Right? And they're going to say, I'm not going to deal with this and take it into the shop because, you know, it's going to slow me down. Yeah, and so I think, you know, it's got to be a comprehensive kind of look at that stuff. And when you do look at the big truckload carriers, where they do have more success, where I hear from happy drivers is, you know, they're on dedicated routes. And those dedicated routes are a lot of drop and hook, a lot of preloaded trailers for big shippers. You know, the challenge there is obviously, you know, these smaller, how do these smaller carriers plug in there? You know, can they do just power only for one customer? If they're not working for that customer, you know, what are they moving without a trailer? You know, I think those are some of the, you know, it favors, I think, the bigger operators. But I completely agree with you. You got to ensure that maintenance is done, and that the driver can either count on it or is going to be paid to make sure that everything's fixed for the next guy. And obviously, you know, down in the ports and places like that, I hear from drivers all the time, and, you know, they're just...
Oh, my God, yeah.
Oh, boy. don't get them started on, you know, maintenance or chassis maintenance. It's, you know, it's a headache for sure.
Yeah, well, there's just too many hands, especially on in the chassis pool.
I'm looking at the time, gentlemen, and we have blown through the hour.
Jeez, that didn't take long.
Well, I have certainly enjoyed it, guys.
I would like to give Steve the opportunity, you know, to tell us, you know, give us some information on some other things that he may have going on, some things where we might be able to follow him and keep up with him. Steve, if you want to, you know, you can give us all your social media or any other projects that you got going on that you would like to get some exposure on that we could keep up with you and read up on. We definitely would love to hear about it. So the floor is yours, my friend.
Well, thank you, Rico. So believe it or not, I don't do any social media, but I do have a website. It's Steve Viscelli, Viscelli.com. And you know, what I'm working on right now that I'm pretty excited about is this book on self-driving trucks. And, you know, I share a lot of your skepticism, Chuck, but I kind of lay out where this stuff came from, you know, mainly military spending in the U.S. And how I think it might realistically kind of play out with, you know, ADAS systems and sort of automation sort of step-by-step for drivers. So I'm pretty excited about that project. It's not out yet. But at the website, you know, folks can link to my book, The Big Rig. I always love to get feedback from, you know, people in the industry with different perspectives on that. And then what I've been really working on lately is the around the infrastructure bill is this idea for truck parking and these things I call urban truck ports, which are kind of this way to provide a charging network for local electric trucks, but then allowing long-haul trucks, you know, still using diesel to become more efficient, right? And so if you're only running them highway miles, right, what can you do with, you know, your speccing for horsepower and your gearing and, you know, aerodynamics and, you know, rolling resistance of tires? So ways that we can really, you know, cut fuel costs, potentially create these more regular lanes for drivers who might run kind of drop lot to drop lot like you used to under regulation, and then still facilitate that desire that a lot of places have for, you know, those zero emission vehicles and things like that that I think are just inevitably going to sort of gain in importance for some urban areas, like particularly California. So that's, you know, I've got a video out on YouTube, a little 2-minute thing where you can sort of see a cartoon animation of what these things would look like. And that's really what I'm excited about these days. And maybe sometime down the road, I can come back on and we can talk about how we're going to get that done.
Well, it's going to be in the near future, because this hour really blew by so quickly, and I really enjoyed having you on as a guest. It was a real honor.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, and best of luck with everything, and stay healthy and safe.
Thanks. You too.
All right, guys.
Thanks.
All right, good evening. Bye-bye. Appreciate it. And we want to thank you guys. Chuck, you, before we get out of here, I almost forgot. Tell people how they can get in contact with you.
Sure. Give me a buzz if anybody needs me. My extension is 203. Phone number is 1-800-388-4352. Again, extension 203. Or just email me, chuck@traffix.com, T-R-A-F-F-I-X. If you want to get set up as a carrier, if I can help you with anything, give me a call. Run up on me. Thanks, Rico.
Appreciate it. Well, thank you guys, ladies and gentlemen, for hanging out with us for a little while. We definitely appreciate it. Could have been anywhere else in the world, but you took a little time to hang out with us. We're always eternally grateful for that. But with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we will talk with you same time, same place, God willing, next week. Be safe out there. Stay healthy. Keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise. And we'll talk at you next week. God bless and good night.
Catch you on the flip-flop. God bless.